We're exhausted, but start setting up for the night. Firewood is scarce, mostly damp furs. We build the campfire on the logs, too tired to dig a fire pit. Dinner's in the tent, nice and warm. Can't imagine such comfort on the ridge, with howling wind outside, hundreds of kilometers away from human settlements. The last diary entry of the Dyatlov Group. Humans, welcome to the Oddity Archive. I am David Stuhldreher. I'm here with my co-host Evan.
Howdy.
Hey, how's life, Evan?
Got the cats and the partner at home. Everybody's happy, doing our thing. How about you?
Not too bad. I'm anxious to get started with today's story. I pulled a good file for us. I think we're gonna have a fun time digging into it.
Yeah, so you said a good file. You have invited me onto a podcast, which I don't really know what it is about. Do you want to tell me why I'm here?
Yeah, so I've actually tricked you a little bit. I've lured you here into my pillow fort by telling you to just get comfortable, listen to a couple stories. I think what really sealed the deal was telling you that I'd give you unlimited Mountain Dew while you're here.
Yeah, that's the quickest way to get me to agree to do anything.
Yeah, fun fact for our listeners, actually. Evan is the inventor of Code Red Mountain Dew.
Yeah. It's crushed strawberries and regular Mountain Dew. That's all it takes.
Yeah, very simple, very simple. And so I lured you here telling you I was just going to tell you some stories, but really it was kind of a self-serving purpose. I need closure. I need closure on the stories that I'm going to tell you. And so your job is to become the definitive authority on what happened in each one of these stories.
And these are things that happened to you?
No. So these are odd, unusual paranormal happenings from around the world, different times. We'll probably talk about some things decades old, maybe even centuries old. So no pressure. You have to answer these mysteries that have not been solved by anyone previously.
I think I'm well tasked for the job.
Excellent. And so I guess to jump into today's story, a simple question. Have you ever heard of the Dyatlov Pass incident?
Can you say that one more time?
The Dyatlov Pass incident.
I have no knowledge on that whatsoever.
And disclaimer to everybody, there's a lot of Russian words that are going to be said today, and there's no way I'm going to pronounce all of them correctly, so I apologize in advance.
We're a couple of Virginia boys, so we'll try our best.
And so just to sum it up for you, the Dyatlov Pass incident is a case of 9 Russian hikers who passed away mysteriously in the Ural Mountains. And so that's where we're going to get.
Okay.
But I think to start off, it would be important to talk about the people involved.
Right.
I think really that's the backbone of this story, is the 9 hikers. Well, really 10 hikers, and we'll talk about why traditionally you hear 9 hikers. But I think getting to know them a little bit will really inform any information or any decisions you make towards the end of this episode.
Cool. So, can I jump in and ask questions when I need to, or should I let you kind of get through story beats and then...
Questions, comments, welcome. Feel free to interrupt me.
I will frequently, as much as possible.
Yeah, right. Please do.
Okay, great.
And so to start off, like I said, we'll go over the 10 hikers that were involved with this incident. And I've got a couple notes on some of them, others I don't have notes on. There's a lot of information out there about this case. Because we'll get into exactly what they were doing, but they were all keeping diaries and taking a lot of photographs during this expedition. And so there is no shortage of information that you can look up when you look into the Dyatlov Pass incident. It's actually, I would say, having looked at this for probably the past 10 days, it's a frustratingly large amount of information.
Mm-hmm.
Because as soon as you think you know what happened, or you have a good idea of what happened, you learn something else that basically is like, yeah, there's no way that could have happened.
Right. So what year are we talking? When did this all happen?
Good question. So this is 1959, and this is in Russia, in the middle of Russia. We'll get into more specifics on location once we get into the actual journey.
Okay.
But I wanted to go over the nine hikers, or 10. I'm going to keep saying 9 and 10. I'm going to keep messing that up this whole time until the one drops out. And then we'll just know that there's 9.
Right.
But like I said, there's a lot of information there. You could do a full hour on each one of these people. But I'm just going to give some quick notes, give their names, and then we'll move on from there. And so the first one, Igor Dyatlov.
And I hope you don't mind. I might make some notes over here to kind of track. And don't worry, I will misspell all of the names.
Well, I'm going to mispronounce them. You'll misspell them.
Between the two of us, we'll at least get Dyatlov by the end of it.
Yeah, Dyatlov. That's
that's the easy one. All right, so Igor, and what was his last name?
Igor Dyatlov. As you have guessed by now, he is the one this case is named after.
Okay.
He was 23 years old, and all of these, with the exception of one, were students at the Ural Polytechnic Institute. And so when we talk about this case, a lot of people will say that it's the case of 9 Russian students. But I think that's doing them a disservice. They were students, but I think some of that implies that they didn't really know what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the course of learning about them and learning about this case, you'll come to realize that, yes, they were students, but they were extremely experienced hikers and mountaineers, and they knew what they were doing, which just adds to the intrigue of what happened to them.
Gotcha. Is there any relevance to what they were studying?
Yeah, great question. So Igor Dyatlov, the first one that we're talking about, radio engineering, that's actually what he was studying. And he actually built his own shortwave radios. That was one thing that he was really interested in.
Cool.
Some of the other ones, they were studying nuclear physics, and then a couple of them were also studying economics.
A smart crew, it sounds like.
Yeah, definitely a very smart crew. And sort of to demonstrate that, I was reading up on Igor Dyatlov prior to this incident. And he actually, in 1957, so 2 years prior, Russia launched Sputnik, one of, if not the first, satellites to go into space. That was 1957, and Igor Dyatlov actually built his own telescope so that he could watch it launch. And so he was an intelligent person.
Yeah, sounds like
And I think he was the leader of the group. I think that is the best word to describe him.
Okay.
He was a respected leader. He was the guy at the school that you wanted to go on expeditions with.
Yeah.
People would seek him out. There's a story that on a prior expedition, him and his group of hikers found themselves being run down by a group of wild horses. And he was able to very quickly get them organized, form a semicircle with their backs to the horses, and the horses ran right around them. And I feel like that could have very easily went south. The next one, Yuri Doroshenko. He was 21 years old. He, like I said, these are all students at the university, with the exception of one of them, and we'll get to him at the end. The next one is Ludmila Dubinina. She was 20 years old. And to give you an idea of the toughness of this group, she, on a previous trip, had been shot accidentally by a hunter. And by all reports, after being shot, while being lugged out of the woods, she was joking and laughing and making light of the situation. And so this is an intelligent group, also a tough group. The next one is Yuri Krivanashenko. And the only note that I have for him is that he brought a mandolin on the expedition.
Who doesn't?
Yeah. You know, you got to have one guy that's able to pull something out around a campfire and play a song or two.
Wonderwall. He's got to break out.
Yeah. That's probably what they were working on. They were ahead of their time. I think the fact that he brought a mandolin shows that, yes, they were strong, they were intelligent, they were tough and rugged, but also they were creative. They had a creative side to them. Next few, I don't really have any notes on. Alexander Kolotov, Zina Kolmogorova. That's what we're going to go with.
We'll just call her Zina.
Zina. We're sticking with Zina. Yeah. The next one, Rustam Slobodin. He was 23. I should say Zina was 22. Alexander was 24. So all early 20s.
Okay.
And then the next one, Nikolai Thibodeau Brignole. He was 23. And then Yuri Yudin. He was 21. He is the 10th hiker. He's oftentimes called the survivor of this incident. A bit of a misnomer. He wasn't in the tent when whatever happened. And so he was on the expedition he started, but you'll see he didn't make it to the end of this.
A lot of Yuris, it sounds like.
We got 3 Yuris here.
Okay, so were these guys all friends, or was this like a group that organized with the school or something like that?
Yeah, so the all of these folks, they were friends. They had all been on previous expeditions together. They knew their roles. They knew how each person was going to react in any given situation. Like I said, Igor Dyatlov, he was the unquestioned leader of the group. But yeah, they were all familiar with each other. They had worked together quite a bit in the past.
Okay.
And then we have, it's good you asked that question at that time, because then we have the one sort of outlier. And his name is Semyon Zolotarov. And he was 38 years old. So he was the old man of the group.
He's the creeper in the group.
Yeah, you know, that's an oddly accurate way to describe him.
There's one in every group.
Yeah, because so he was a World War II vet. He had tattoos, which was very no-no back then.
Not quite like it is today where everybody's got one. Back then it was, it kind of put you in a certain kind of group.
Yeah. And most of his tattoos also, it's worth noting, were military tattoos. And so they were...
Were they dodgy military tattoos, or just like he's seen some combat, so he's...
Yeah, they were more... I wouldn't call them dodgy tattoos. It was more, I've seen combat.
Okay.
I've been in situations where, you know, I had to defend myself, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so it was like his command unit or that kind of stuff.
And it wasn't uncommon for Russian soldiers to be tattooed back then. It was just this group of students... He was the only one that had any tattoos, and he had quite a few.
Okay.
It's also worth noting that he was added to the trip last minute. And the next thing we'll go over is the certification they were going for. But he had been part of an expedition that was set to leave to get this certification. And I'm not sure why, but for some reason, his expedition was unable to get started.
Okay.
And so he went to the board that governs the certifications, and they sort of placed him into the Dyatlov group.
Okay, so he was not with the friend group. He's kind of the, I mean, you mentioned he's an outlier, but not just because of his vibe. He also just was kind of added on.
Yeah, correct. So he wasn't just an outlier because of his age or because of his military career. He was an outlier also because he didn't know these people prior to this expedition. I will say, though, by all accounts, diary entries, photographs, he fit in very quickly. He wasn't like off to the side of the campfire every night just grumbling to himself. Like,
yeah, he was not an outsider. He kind of just fell into the fold pretty quick with everybody
else. Fell into the fold. Everybody enjoyed having him around. And so the certification these folks were trying to get was their grade 3 hiking certification, which would have made them a master of sport in Russia. So this was the highest certification you could get for any kind of hiking, mountaineering, master of sports stuff.
You're like the black belt of...
Yeah. So if you get this, you're the Russian Bruce Lee of hiking. So this was not... Well, I'll go through the specifications. So what they had to accomplish in order to get this certification was they had to do a 300-kilometer hike, 100 kilometers of which had to be, quote, overcoming natural obstacles. And so what that would mean is 100 kilometers of the 300, they would have to have steep climbs or steep descents. It would have to be deep snow skiing or in dense forest.
Who decides what counts, or is it you present your trail and then they say, okay, there's 100 kilometers that counts as...
Yeah, so I'm not clear on who decides the route.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it was Dyatlov, you know, proposed this route, gave it to the board and they approved it, or if it was the other way around and Dyatlov was like, hey, I got a group, I want to get this certification.
And they're
and
like, here's your
the
route.
Group was like, well, then do this.
Okay.
I'm not sure which way that went.
But still gives us a good idea of, like, it doesn't sound like an easy hike.
No, this is not an easy hike. So it had to be a minimum of 16 days. And 8 days of those had to be in, quote, unpopulated area. And they specified that as you had to be 50 to 60 kilometers from the nearest village. So you had to be not close to anything. And then of the 16 total days, you had to have 6 nights in completely winter conditions. Is what it said.
This is in Russia too, just to remind
you. This is in Russia.
It's going to be pretty cold.
And you'll see this is in the dead of winter.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Russia is largely uninhabitable during winter months.
Yes, this expedition took place sort of just into Siberia. Yeah, this is not you and I at 13 years old setting up a tent in your mom's side yard.
It had its own brutal conditions for other reasons, but mostly, you know, we were trying to make Mountain Dew Code Red.
We had to get a lot of strawberries into that.
Yeah, right, right. A lot of berry crushing.
Yeah. And so six nights had to be in completely winter conditions, and there's differing opinions on what this meant. I've read two different ideas from different sources. So completely winter conditions to some people meant they could not use their stove. They could not use any heat. Other people would say that completely winter conditions means they could only use the equipment that they brought with them, which would include the stove. And the stove will become an important aspect of this. So we're unsure exactly what completely winter conditions meant, but those were the specifications to get this certification.
So not for the faint of heart. That's like, you need to be pretty good at this to even want to start this thing.
Exactly. And so they had to have already gotten their grade 2 certification, which if those are the requirements for grade 3, grade 2 would just be a step below. So these people knew what they were doing. You can't get any higher certification for mountaineering and hiking in Russia in 1959. By all accounts, what happened to them should not have happened. And, you know, like I said, at the end of this, you'll tell me what happened.
Yeah.
All right. So now that we've talked about who they were, what they were trying to accomplish, I'll start getting into the timeline of what happened. This whole journey started on January 23rd, 1959. So like I said, middle of winter.
Yeah.
On the 23rd, their route book was issued. Whether that was Dyatlov proposing a route or the school just issuing them one, I'm not sure. But the route book was issued, and they were eager to get started. They wanted the certification. So the exact same day, they departed Yekaterinburg. That's what it's called now. I'm not sure what it was called in 1959, but that's the modern name.
So they were ready to go. They got their paper, and they're like, let's get
it. Yeah, they were ready to go. They were packed. They were, as soon as they got it, they hit the road.
Gotcha.
2 days later, on the 25th, they arrived at Sverdlovsk Oblast. I'm going to guess that's correct. So they had a 2-day train trip. And then from there, after they arrived, they drove to Vizhai. 2 days later, on the 27th, that's when the real trip started. They took a van to get to basically the starting point.
Right. None of that counts towards their days. They're just getting to location, basically.
Correct. And so on the 27th, the trek really started. The ultimate goal was to summit the mountain Gora Orton.
Okay.
And then return, and that route would have fulfilled all of the requirements that they needed for the certification.
So this is not an A to B trek. It's A to B back to A would be the full trip.
Correct, correct. And so the 27th, the trip really starts. The next day on the 28th, they wake up, and Yuri Yudin, he's not feeling well. He had had a variety of medical issues going into this, but he really wanted his certification. But once he got a day into the trip in the harsh winter conditions, once they got into that Siberia area, he woke up that morning and decided, I just don't think I can do this. What we know from the diaries, he left because he didn't want to be a burden to the other hikers. So it's kind of a selfless decision that ultimately saved his life.
Yeah.
And then 3 days later, on the 31st, they get to an edge of a wooded area that's really sort of the flat part of this hike and starting to go up the mountain.
Okay.
And they spent a lot of their time building a cache for their supplies. And so they knew, okay, now's when it really gets serious.
Mm-hmm.
Let's put everything we don't need here and keep it here until we get back.
So that's not to take with them. That's like, we need to travel as light as possible.
Correct.
Did they just like bury this stuff in the ground?
Yeah, great question. It was called a labaz. I think it was a raised structure that they built to basically keep all of their stuff safe. They stored everything that was not essential there. And so, unfortunately, they had to store the mandolin there.
Oh,
there's going to be no more music from here on out.
That was the only fun they had. I feel like maybe they were forced to do that too. Like, dude, we can't have any more songs, man. We got to leave the mandolin, dude. We're done.
Yeah. So they stored everything they didn't need in this labaz. And so on February 1st, they got a late start to the day. The plan was they had to get through a pass and then go up the mountain. You'll probably guess what that pass becomes named. But the plan that day was get through the pass and then go up the mountain, continue the hike.
As far as like eating and stuff, I mean, they just have like rations that they eat out of their backpacks and stuff? I mean, I imagine there's no like foraging happening in the dead of winter, right? They have to carry all their food with them that they're going to eat for this whole trip.
Correct. So they carried all the food that they needed with them.
That must be a super heavy backpack for how much calories you're going to be burning.
I will say though, they were skilled. They knew what they were doing. They left all of the return food in the Labaz.
Okay.
They only took what they needed for getting over the pass, up the mountain and back.
Okay. So they're approaching the
pass.
Yeah.
And so they get a late start to the day and they start going up out of the woods towards the pass before they decide, okay, the weather's getting worse. The sun is starting to go down. Let's build our tent.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to see the area, I wouldn't say it would be logical to build the tent here. But when interviewed, Yuri Yudin, the one who dropped out, he believed that Dyatlov decided to set up the tent there because he didn't want to lose the ground they had made.
Okay.
We're talking rough terrain, very deep snow, and so it would have been a whole extra day to go back down to the woods, set up your tent, and then start over.
Oh, I see. So he didn't want to lose progress by having to backtrack. He was like, yeah, we burnt the energy to get here. Let's go ahead and just set up camp here and make it worth it.
Correct. And so they set up the camp that night. Now, the next piece of information is that when Yuri Yudin left the expedition, Dyatlov had told him, I will send you a telegram by February 12th letting you know how it went. If we succeeded, if we failed, you know, what's going on with this group. So February 12th comes around, and you guessed it, no telegram.
Right.
So Yuri Yudin starts getting a little bit worried.
And to send that, you'd have to be like back into society, right? Call it quits or be successful.
Yeah. And he said that'll happen by the 12th.
Okay.
That doesn't happen. So the days keep passing. And on February 20th, Yuri Yudin started being like, okay, this is getting past the point of, okay, they just got held up a couple days.
Yeah.
Their families had started getting a little distraught. And so by the 20th, they decide, okay, we're going to send out a search party. We're going to try and figure out what happened to this group of people. So the search party heads out on February 20th. And I think it illustrates just how remote this place was. It took them until the 26th to find anything. So it took a whole search party 6 days to find the tent.
And given the time frame, I mean, this is what, 1959, right? Yeah. There's no helicopters or anything like that to do the search party. Like, are they just going in on foot with like dogs or something? Like, what's that process look like back then?
So actually, everything you just said is exactly what they did. So they went in on foot.
Uh-huh.
After a while, they brought in dogs. And then there is an interesting piece about a helicopter that was brought in that we'll get into when we start getting into theories about what may or may not have happened.
Okay.
And so on the 26th, they find the tent. And some interesting stuff about the tent is all the supplies are still in the tent.
All the stuff that wasn't left in that L thing.
The Labaz.
The Labaz. Yeah,
correct. Most of the supplies are in there. There's uneaten food in there that's kind of wrapped up neatly. The stove is in there, and the stove has not been assembled.
Okay.
And so this goes back to when I was talking about needing a certain number of cold nights. We don't really know if that was they weren't allowed to set up the stove or if they were allowed to set up the stove. Certainly the stove not being set up is explained by a requirement of not being allowed
to set it up. Yeah, if they had
to
check a box, that may be why.
But again, it doesn't make much sense to me that you would choose this sort of makeshift spot for a tent as one of your cold nights if you're on this expedition.
Right.
If you're going up here and you're like, okay, we're not going to make it to where we want to. We got to set up the tent here. It's getting down to negative 22 degrees Fahrenheit. Let's just throw in this as one of our cold nights.
Yeah.
And the stoves back then, they weren't like just screw in a propane tank and hit a button. It took about an hour and a half or so to set this stove up.
And so when you say stove, is this purely for heat or is this something they would cook on? Or I imagine most of the rations they kept were like basically you just open a thing and can eat it. But I mean, was it for food too or just heat?
Yeah, for both.
Okay.
But the reason we know how long it took to set the stove up is that they took copious notes in their diaries. And so they actually had sort of a running competition amongst them of who could set the stove up the fastest.
Okay. And did you already say how quick that was, or did...
I think the fastest they set it up was just over an hour.
Okay. So it takes, you know, it's not no time.
It's doable, but it is an undertaking. A couple other things about the tent is that most of their clothes and shoes remained in the tent. And then they noticed that the tent had been cut open. And this is kind of the most famous piece of information about this story, mm-hmm. is that the tent had been cut open, and after analysis, so they didn't know it on the 26th, but after analysis, they figured out that the tent had been cut open from the inside. So these hikers cut themselves out of the tent.
Well, just that's weird, right? Like, there's no reason I would think these highly skilled hikers would think I need to cut my way out of here.
Correct. Really, the crux of this entire happening is, why did they leave the tent? That's the question.
Yeah.
So they find the tent. They find that it had been cut open from the inside. Most of the supplies are left. The stove isn't set up. They start searching around that area. They now have sort of a jumping off point for, where are we going to look for other stuff? About a mile away, down at the tree line. So remember, they had hiked up from the tree line on the 1st of February. So the searchers went down towards the tree line, and they found the remains of a fire.
How do they know where they're at each day? Is there like a diary or something that they are able to reference into, like, where they were when?
Yeah, so half the documentation is sort of, we were at the fire and these things were happening and it was fun and we had a competition to set up the stove. But really, the backbone of the diaries is making sure that they have documented everything they need to do to accomplish this certification.
Gotcha.
And there's also, I think I mentioned, a lot of photographs that they had taken.
Yeah.
There were numerous cameras with them. You can go online and find hundreds of pictures of this group.
Okay.
Before the fateful night.
It's funny to me, too, with how much gear they have and all that stuff. Like, cameras back then were pretty bulky, so to take that is just, like, kind of another pain point, but... I guess also cool to document what you're doing, and kind of one of the few people in this area at this time, I'm sure, too.
I think it speaks to how badly they wanted the certification. They didn't all take their cameras with them, but they did take a camera with them mm-hmm. to the tent site.
Okay.
So even with all of their essential supplies stored away, they were like, we still need to document what's going on so that we can get the certification.
So at least one camera with them, maybe more, but who knows?
And so they go down to the tree line, which is about a mile away, and they find the remains of a fire. And analysis showed that this fire had burned for about 2 hours. Shortly after that, they notice that there are some remains near the fire.
And sorry, I just wrote my frame of reference. So this would be like backtracking a mile, right, from where that
correct
tent was.
Correct.
So theoretically, they were at this tent, left it, and made it a mile away to that second campfire site.
Yeah, correct.
Okay.
And from what I was able to determine, if you think of sort of like a triangle, they left the tree line, hiked up to the campsite,
mm-hmm.
and then whatever happened, happened. And where they found this fire and the first remains that we'll talk about was sort of back down towards the tree line, but at the incorrect angle. So I think there is an argument to be made that when they left the tent, they were trying to get back to the Labazz, to all of their supplies. But given the conditions in the middle of the night, they were just disoriented. And they ended up back at the tree line, but at a different place than where they had stored their items.
So, like, what do you think they were going back to that for? Because it sounded like they still had some supplies in their tent and stuff. Is there something they would have stashed that they were like, oh, like, that actually is maybe what we need?
Probably not. And the reason I say that is because of the brutal conditions that they were in. So this wouldn't be a simple, oh, we forgot the mandolin. We could really use some music tonight. I'll just hike back down real quick and grab it.
Yeah.
This was really deep snow. And so it took them half a day to go the mile or two to the campsite.
Yeah, you really need a reason to go back.
Yeah, you need a reason to leave the tent.
Yeah.
And you really need a reason to go all the way back down to where you had left your supplies.
Right.
And so near this fire, they found the remains of Yuri Krivonoshenko and Yuri Doroshenko. And they were wearing only their underwear.
All the Yuris are out now. No more Yuris on the expedition.
All the Yuris.
Yuried out.
We're yuried out. And both of these individuals, Kravonoshenko and Doroshenko, they were in only their underwear.
Ooh.
So they did not have any clothes on. They did have some burn marks on their hands and feet, almost as though they were trying to get so close to the fire that it ended up burning them.
Hmm. So where my head goes there, they probably took off their clothes, because I know when you are in the element, if your clothes get wet, you're supposed to take them off because it cools more than just if you're not wearing anything at all. So
their clothes could have gotten wet, but again, most of their clothes were left in the tent. There is something that we'll talk about called paradoxical undressing, where someone suffering from hypothermia will feel like they're really warm and take their clothes off. But the fact that they had burn marks and they were probably really close to this fire tells me they were feeling cold.
Yeah.
And so they were in only their underwear. They were near a cedar tree, and the branches of the tree up to 5 meters had been broken off.
Oh, so they were pulling firewood, presumably.
Presumably they were pulling firewood. Potentially somebody climbed up to try and get sight of the tent.
Yeah.
It's worth noting that this night was a moonless night, so there was not any light, and it was not snowing. So it was a clear night, but it was very, very dark.
Yeah.
So they could have climbed up the tree to try and get a sight of the tent, or like you said, they could have been pulling branches to try and feed this fire.
Mm-hmm.
So they're found on the 26th.
Okay, and so just so I keep the body count straight, how many people are we IDing there?
They have found 2 bodies.
So one left early, and now there's two accounted for.
Correct.
Okay.
And so we have 7 more people to go.
Gotcha.
And so then they wrap up the search for that day. It had just gotten a little bit too late in the day. The sun was going down, and they restarted again on the 27th.
Okay.
So they brought in some search dogs, and they were able to find about 300 meters from that fire site, that the cedar tree with the broken branches, about 300 meters towards the tent, they found Igor Dyatlov. And then 630 meters towards the tent was Zina.
Were they were dressed still?
They were not dressed well. They were not dressed for the elements. They were more, got woken up in the middle of the night and had to go.
Okay.
So they found Igor Dyatlov, they found Zina, and then about a week later, on March 5th, they found Rustam Slobodin. And they found him sort of between Dyatlov and Zina. And they were all sort of in a line, and they were all facing like they were trying to go back to the tent.
So all going the same direction.
Yeah, all going the same direction, in a line, and all the evidence tells us they were trying to get back to the tent.
Okay.
Everything kind of goes cold for a little bit. And then 2 months later, after the snow had started to melt a little bit, and they were able to get to the area a little bit more efficiently, they went back, and on May 5th, further down into the tree line, there's a ravine. And in the ravine, I think this was 75 meters or so further into the woods than the cedar tree with the broken branches and the original site where they found the first 2 bodies. They find Ludmila Dubinina. She had a major chest injury. She had numerous broken ribs. And then another thing that you'll hear almost every time you hear about this case is her tongue and her eyes were gone.
Yikes.
And so they find her. I'm going to go through these 4 as a group and then sort of give you a little more information.
Okay. Yeah, I'll let you run through it.
And so she had no tongue and no eyes, and she had a major chest injury, numerous broken ribs. I think she also had some facial wounds. Next, they find Alexander Kolotov, and they simply determined that he had died of hypothermia. And it's important to note that the previous folks, the ones by the fire and the other ones in the line going back to the tent, their cause of death was all hypothermia.
Okay.
It's worth noting, though, that Rustam Slobodin, the one that was kind of in the middle of the 3 going back to the tent,
yeah,
he had some major damage to his skull.
Okay.
But they determined that the cause of death was hypothermia. And so they find Ludmila, they find Kolotov, and then the next one they find is Semyon Zolotarov.
And he's the older guy.
Yeah, he's the older guy. He's the war veteran. He's the tattooed guy. He also had a major chest injury. And they find him with a camera around his neck. So there are some theories about why he would have his camera around the neck. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about some of those, but
especially if you're in survival mode, presumably you would ditch the camera.
You would think so, yeah. But they found him with a camera around his neck. And then the last individual and the last person on the expedition that they find is Nikolai Thibodeau Brignole. There's no way I'm pronouncing that correctly.
We apologize in advance to his family.
Nothing makes sense to me. And he had major, major skull damage. So his cause of death was determined to be skull damage. It's worth noting that the two folks that had a major chest injury as their cause of death, mm-hmm. So Ludmila and Semyon.
Yes.
It was determined by the coroner that the damage done to their chest area could not have been done by a human.
Interesting.
It was, he likened it to getting hit directly in the chest by a car going 30 miles an hour.
So out of curiosity, was anything like removed? Like were organs taken out? Like were they, did it look like they were being eaten by wild creatures, or this was purely just like blunt force trauma?
So this was blunt force trauma. There was no outward appearance of injury.
Okay.
This was all discovered after they had gotten the bodies back and started doing an investigation into it.
Okay.
You did hit on a good piece of information with the missing eyes and tongue.
Yeah.
It's a lot of people, when they hear about this story, that's sort of like the hook piece that they'll hear is like, oh my gosh, somebody was found without eyes or a tongue. It's fairly easily explained away as scavengers got to her body, unfortunately.
And animal scavengers, not like people.
Animal scavengers got to her body. And those are just the easiest, softest parts of the body that an animal could consume, presumably. Yeah. And so that, in my mind, that explains the missing body parts.
Okay, cool. So by my count, that's everybody on the expedition, right? So we know that the chest damage wasn't from humans. And the leading theory on the missing body parts is just that scavenging animals probably came by. That's the easiest part for them to eat. So that explains that. But are there any theories out there as far as like what happened?
Oh, are there? So there are a lot of theories out there about what happened to this group of hikers. And we'll go over some of the more realistic ones, some of the not likely ones. But I want to kind of give you the breadth of ideas about what happened here.
Okay.
And so we'll start off with the ones that I feel like are a bit less likely, and then maybe we'll move into some that have a little more substance to them.
And where do these theories come from?
You could liken this case, this is sort of Russia's JFK assassination.
Okay.
And so there are a lot of people in Russia that have ideas about what happened to them.
No shortage of theories on this one.
Yeah. And so some of the less likely ones, and I'm sort of going to go through this and tell you what the theory is and then immediately refute why that's not possible. And this is where this case gets really frustrating.
Okay.
Because every time you think you have an idea what happened, you don't. So there's a local tribe in the area, sort of the closest piece of civilization to where they were, called the Mansi. And they were just the indigenous people of the area. And some people have proposed that they followed the group to the campsite, broke in, murdered everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a couple notes why this is most likely not the case. So the Mansi are well known as peaceful.
Yeah.
They're the last people before you get into the unrelenting frontier of Siberia.
Mm-hmm.
And they are known to help people.
Not a hostile area. They don't mind people passing.
Yeah,
through.
Not a hostile area. Also, they were some of the first people to get involved with the search effort.
Okay.
So they actively, so they're already helping out. Yeah, they were actively trying to help people find the bodies, find out what happened.
It'd be a little weird if they helped out and they're like, oh my God, it was us the whole time.
Yeah. Oh, it was Jimmy. Why would he do that again? So in my opinion, this whole Monsi theory, they called the mountain Dead Mountain. And at first glance, that's not too good of a thing, right?
Yeah.
But they called it that because there was no game there for them to hunt.
The conditions are so rough, not much living stuff to go.
To them, they called it Dead Mountain because it was not worth going there. There was nothing of substance that would help them there.
Does this tribe actually stay there year-round, or do they like...
So they live there year-round. They have permanent settlements there. Yeah. So they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
They're sort of the Sherpas of the area, if you will. The next theory that I think we can just immediately strike off is an escaped convict. This theory is... There's a gulag, a Russian gulag, about 16 miles away from the campsite. And it was an open-air gulag. There's not a fence or anything like that. Because when you're in the middle of Siberia, you don't need a fence.
Because if you leave, you're probably not coming back.
Nature is your fence.
Yeah.
And so some people have proposed that someone escaped from this gulag, trekked 16 miles in the dead of winter to this group's tent, entered the tent, mm-hmm. murdered some of them, and then left without taking anything.
Yeah.
I don't think I really need to go too much further into detail about why that's a ridiculous theory.
Also, the odds of running into these people in this very remote area seems very, very small.
Yeah, it would be quite a coincidence.
Yeah.
And if that was me, if I had hiked 16 miles, I would not be leaving some ham neatly wrapped up in the tent. I would be
I'd go straight for the ham.
Yeah. So that one, not likely. And then the next... probably not the case theory is a Yeti got them. And there's actually, I think the History Channel or the Discovery Channel, someone made like a 2-hour documentary about this theory called The Russian Killer Bigfoot.
Okay, because my next question is to confirm, Yetis are not real. Or are they?
You know, I think we're going to get into that in later episodes.
Okay, so we'll say we'll put a pin in that for now.
Yeah, we'll put a pin in that, whether or not Yetis are real or not. However, the chance that a Yeti stalked this group and killed them brutally, probably not likely. This whole theory and that entire 2-hour documentary is based on a single picture that was taken during the expedition. And this picture is, as you guessed it, a blurry photo of a creature that looks human, mm-hmm. standing in the woods, sort of appearing from behind a tree.
Did this area have any like folklore even about this Yeti, or there's just that one photo is kind of the only source of that theory?
That photo is the source of this theory because
there's no previous Yeti stories about this area that
correct.
Would lean into that.
Okay. Correct. This was not a Yeti hotbed.
Gotcha.
So this theory, like I said, is predicated on this one photo. And the reason I think that we can kind of get rid of this is that if you take the series of pictures that this was around, there are other pictures that are in focus mm-hmm. that show someone dressed in colors that look exactly the same as the person in the quote-unquote Yeti picture.
This is the film era also, so it's not like you necessarily see your photo, delete a bad take. You probably just take another one.
Correct, yeah. Correct. Yeah, and so I feel like that kind of explains that away. Other people that like this theory like to reference that there was a diary entry that I believe Ludmilla had that said something to the effect of, now we know the Bigfoot is real. There's a certain word that the hikers would use for Bigfoot, mm-hmm. or Russians would use for Bigfoot. And so she references that. That's the whole theory, basically.
Yeah.
And they also were working on a fake newspaper to give to their friends when they got back.
Okay.
The ultimate goal was to get to Gora Orton. And so they had kind of concocted this Orton Times dispatch or something like that, that they were working on to sort of give to their friends when they came back.
Like an inside joke kind of.
Yeah, thing. Funny stories. Yeah. And so they were creative.
Okay.
And so her writing something about, now the Bigfoot's real, is not necessarily like a word for word thing that she experienced.
Yeah, gotcha.
So that one, probably not likely.
Right.
So let's get into some of the theories that have a little more substance to them.
Okay.
So the first one that I want to talk about, wild animals, specifically not the Yeti. So some people say that a wild animal could have startled them in their tent and caused them to cut their way out, leave the tent. I looked into bears because I was thinking, what kind of animal could appear at the front of a tent that would cause me to cut myself out of it and just
and be strong enough to like fracture your skull and crush in your chest.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I looked into bears. They were in the range of brown bears. They were after the hibernation time.
Okay. That's for brown bears. Yeah.
Yeah. And so is it possible a brown bear went to the front of the tent, startled them? I think that is within the realm of possibility.
Yeah.
However, for the tent to still be so neat and all of the individuals be so far from the tent, I think it's more likely than a Yeti, but still, I don't think very likely.
Well, and you mentioned earlier, look, they cut from inside the tent to get out. So the bear would almost have to be in the tent with them to need that kind of urgency to cut your way out. And the bear would also have to be doing a lot of groundwork here to be doing all these murders or whatever you want to call them over this like widespread area, like kind of bodies all throughout.
Yeah, he would have either had to track them down and murder them.
Yeah.
Or I guess it is possible he could have just been curious about the tent. And when they all took off, he was like, well, great. Now there's a comfortable place for me to sleep.
Yeah.
But again, a bear is going to destroy things a bit more just by being in
an area. Everything was neat and tidy, basically, in the tent still, apart from that cut out.
Right. Yeah. And having just woken up from hibernation, because it was after their hibernation period, but only by a few weeks, there wouldn't have been any food left in the tent. That bear is going to scarf that stuff.
That's what I was thinking, too. Like, that's probably the first thing it would go to is the food in the tent.
Even if the people ran away, it'd be like, oh, well, here's some free food. And that would definitely be gone.
Yeah.
So also worth noting, there were no animal tracks around the tent. They were able to find 9 sets of prints leading away from the tent, all accounted for. So wild animal, we're tipping the scale a little bit more towards the more likely, but
more
still
believable, but
we're not quite there.
Okay.
The next one, this could be animal related, is something called infrasound.
Okay. I haven't heard of that. What's that?
So infrasound is a phenomenon that happens when audio, I think it's a certain frequency or pitch or volume, some quality of the audio happens and it induces fear and panic in people.
It's like a certain tone that would make you just like start freaking out.
Yeah. And so this has been noted in nature. I believe lions or tigers, some of the big cats can create infrasound when they're growling or angry. Or
okay.
Like sort of a you need to get away from me type of thing.
Defense mechanism that they can use to...
Yeah. And so it has been shown that people who are around the big cats making these noises do have a sense of fear or panic, even if the animal is like on the other side of a barrier and cannot possibly get to them.
Okay.
So the idea here, I think, is not so much wild animal caused it, but wind causing it, because wind blowing in a certain way can sort of cause this.
Yeah.
If you've ever been in a car where like one of the windows is open, that's not infrasound, but that's an odd thing that wind can do. And it's really, you don't like that. You want to get away from that. So you open another window or close the one. And so infrasound is another theory that some people propose, that it was caused, infrasound happened in some sort of way. And it caused the 9 folks to panic and run out of the tent, and the events that followed happened.
Is there, how much science is there to how much that sound can make you do? Like, do you really freak out on that level, or is it really just like, I'm uncomfortable?
So it's more of an I'm uncomfortable type of thing. There was an experiment, and I'm going to get the details of this wrong, where they brought, I want to say 700 people into a space, and they played different frequencies or sounds, or I don't know the exact definition of infrasound, but they played these notes for these people, and one of them was an infrasound.
Okay.
And I think they found that around 22% of the 700 people had a reaction to it.
Okay.
None of them went running, screaming out of the
punching
theater.
Their way out of the wall.
Yeah, like, yeah. I'm in survival mode and I got to get out of here. None of that happened. But infrasound can cause some panic.
Physical reaction. Yeah, but still sounds like it's a bit of a reach.
Yeah, a bit of a reach, I would say.
Okay.
So that one, if it was caused probably by the wind, staying in that vein, the next theory is something called katabatic winds.
Okay.
And this is a wind that's caused by cold air up above, warm air down below, which is rising and sort of sucking the cold air down the slope of the mountain. Okay. I don't know if I explained that in a way that makes any sense.
The viewers can't see the hand gestures, but I get a pretty good visual here going of...
Just imagine me waving my hands wildly.
Yeah.
Basically, the air at the bottom of the mountain is going up because it's warm,
right,
creating a void there, which then sucks the cold air down the mountain. This happens most of the time, but sometimes it can get to an extreme level, and that's when we call it katabatic winds.
Okay. Does that create, like, is this like a vortex that's happening?
I guess you could call it a vortex, but the scale of that vortex would be gigantic.
Yeah.
Like the air going back over to get cold and come down the mountain would be like miles up in the atmosphere.
Okay.
Practically speaking, this would be them in the tent, presumably getting ready to go to bed. We don't really know what time all of this happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then Category 5 hurricane winds
just
come rushing down the mountain towards them. And so the idea here is they were in the tent. These winds picked up. They basically knocked the tent over or messed the tent structure up to a point that the people were basically stuck under the tent.
Mm-hmm.
And they felt the need to then cut themselves out of the tent and get out into the open and try and find better shelter.
Okay.
Which would then lead to them going down to the tree line, maybe trying to regroup, something like that.
Are these events common, these katabatic winds?
I wouldn't say common. When I looked them up, I could only find like a couple YouTube videos of like examples of them. I wouldn't say it's common, but it does exist.
Okay.
Yeah. The next theory, some of these could be combo theories. So you have the katabatic winds. The next one would be an avalanche.
Yeah.
They were on the side of a mountain. This is probably the most popular theory,
mm-hmm,
is that they were on the side of the mountain and an avalanche happened. And the issue with this theory is the tent's still there.
Yeah.
It wasn't completely covered.
And that's what I was thinking with the winds also. Like, if everything's so neat and tidy in there, you would think...
Yeah. When they came back and they found the tent, it was still there. It was still anchored into the ground.
Yeah.
The middle had collapsed. There was some snow on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
But they put their skis up sort of as posts around the tent. Those were still there. And if an avalanche had happened, I feel like the snow would have, again, just done more damage to
this area.
Yeah,
that's a ton of force to just still have your tent up. Like, I think that whole base camp would be like pretty wiped out.
It's also worth noting that the studies that have been done with this area, the slope has been determined to be too little to warrant an avalanche.
Okay. Well, and so when they found these bodies as well, they were presumably on top of the snow, or did they have to like dig in some to find them?
So the first five, they were essentially on top of the snow.
Mm-hmm.
It had been a few weeks. There was some snow on top of them, but...
But not enough to be like...
Not
like
enough.
An avalanche covered them up.
The last four that they found were under 4 meters of snow.
Okay.
And so these are the last four that were in the ravine that had a lot more damage done to their bodies.
Is the amount of time it took to find them versus the first few bodies enough to explain how much snow was on top of them?
So they had to wait those extra couple months for some snow melt to happen before they were able to find these four bodies.
Okay.
Once they found them, there had been a tremendous amount of snow on top of them. It looked like they had tried to build another structure down in the ravine of some sort.
Okay.
That maybe collapsed, and that's what led to all the snow being on top of them. Something occurred that ended up with them with way more snow on top of them than the rest of them. So that's the avalanche theory. There is sort of a subset to the avalanche theory called a slab avalanche.
Okay.
Now, a slab avalanche, this is when some disturbance is done to some snow and a newly fallen layer of snow will sort of slide down. Think of, like, let's say two pieces of cardboard.
Yeah.
On top of each other. If you just hold the bottom one and you lift it up,
yeah,
eventually you're going to get to a point where that top one just slides off. And that's sort of what a slab avalanche is. So this isn't the whole mountain coming crashing down on them. This is a section of one layer of snow sliding down the mountain.
And I imagine that's just like snow kind of settles and then maybe there's a new snowfall that's like then a new layer. So something just kind of disturbs it, whatever, that slab goes.
And so what this theory proposes disturbed it was building the tent.
Okay.
So they had to, because there was that 22 degree slope, so they had to dig out some of the slope to get to a flat surface to build their tent on.
Okay.
And so this theory proposes that digging that section out, building the tent, disturbed the top layer of snow enough to come down on top of their tent.
Okay.
And a slab avalanche can be just a foot of snow. Fun fact about this theory, it was proposed by a guy named Johan Gaum, and he actually proposed this theory after watching Frozen.
So this is recent.
Yeah, this is recent. This is a recent development in the case. He watched Frozen and he was astonished by how well Disney was able to portray snow movement.
Yeah.
And so he actually got with Disney to create a model that would show how this slab avalanche happened and ruined the tent and caused them to panic and leave the tent. And
I like that he heard "Let It Go" and his brain's immediately like,
yeah, love bass.
I got mysteries to solve.
Some notes about this theory, though, is that there was no snowfall on February 1st.
Okay.
There could have been in days prior. Again, nobody was out there to know this, but there was no snowfall on the day that whatever happened, happened.
How much of the weather pattern do we even know from that time? Like, was there much documentation of that sort of thing? And especially for that area, I imagine.
So we know, we can know the moon phase. We know that there was no moon just because you can calculate that out for a million years.
Yeah.
We know there was no snow, I think, because of some diary entries.
Oh, right.
Also, the Mansai, the local tribe, was able to kind of give them an idea. Yeah, it's been cold, it's been windy, it's been snowy, that type of thing.
Diary is a good point too. If they hit any like truly treacherous weather, they probably would have called that out.
Yeah, they definitely would have added an entry, you know, we weren't able to go any further because there's such bad snowfall and all that. So there had been no new snowfall on February 1st. The other just personal opinion on this theory is that, okay, if a slab avalanche had happened, it still doesn't explain to me why they would have just fully abandoned the tent.
Yeah.
Because again, when you look at the picture, and we'll add the relevant pictures that we've referenced here to our social media. When you look at the picture of the tent as it was found, there is some snow on top of it, but it is not covered.
Yeah.
There's not a layer of snow on top of this tent. In my opinion, when you see how the tent was found, it would not warrant just abandoning the tent site.
Yeah.
I would think, all right, let's set the tent back up. Yeah. Like something knocked it over, let's set it back up.
The whole game here, I imagine, is like preserving your calories and stuff. So to reset your whole camp.
Yeah. To set the tent back up is way fewer calories than running to the woods. A whole new base
camp. Yeah, and moving, moving camp.
And so that's the avalanche theory. The next ones are really based on just the time and the place of this occurrence, and that is that the KGB was involved.
Okay, now we're talking.
Yeah, so KGB, and then the next one after this, these kind of, in my opinion, go hand in hand, KGB and or military testing.
Okay.
So this KGB angle really relies on Semyon Zolotarov. He was the older guy that we've talked about a couple times with some military experience. This theory really captures just the time that this took place in.
Yeah.
Because the KGB idea is that Semyon was a spy.
Okay.
And this was during a lot of the nuclear buildup between the United States and Russia.
Yeah.
And so Russia and the United States were constantly trying to deceive each other into where nuclear testing was happening, what kind of nuclear testing was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea behind this angle is that Semyon Zolotarov was hired by the KGB to join this expedition. Again, if you remember, he came on sort of last minute.
Yeah.
In order to get radioactive clothing out into this area so that the United States spies would pick it up and think, okay, they're out there near Gora Orton. That's where they're doing some military testing, some nuclear testing. And so it is worth noting that some of the clothing that was found on the bodies had higher than normal levels of radiation. However, it's also important to remember that one of the areas of study for this group was nuclear physics.
Right, yeah.
And so some of them did work either in a nuclear power plant or some sort of lab using uranium.
Mm-hmm.
And so the amount of radiation that was on their clothing was not out of the ordinary for
that line of work.
That line of work, yeah.
And was that level of radiation on everybody, or did it vary, or do we know that level of detail?
It was only on a few of the pieces of clothing. It was not on everyone.
So it may have just been on the people who were on the nuclear program or whatever.
Correct. And it's important to note that the clothing sort of got all mixed up. So what clothing did make it out of the tent? If you remember the first two folks that were found, they were found in their underwear.
Yeah.
And some of their clothing that we know was their clothing was found on some of the other hikers that were found later. So it's almost as though they passed away.
Yeah.
You know, we're in a survival situation. They don't need it anymore. Let me put it on.
Yeah.
Try and help myself out a little bit.
Right.
The other detractor to this theory is that Semyon died. So I don't know how well the KGB would have covered anything up with him still being there. You would think that if the KGB is involved, they would want the clothing placed and the expedition to otherwise go as planned.
And I would also, it seems odd to me the KGB would have this man do this secret mission with a bunch of college kids.
Yeah. To have him, you're going to train for years to get your grade 2 certification. And then for your grade 3 certification, we're going to stick you with Igor Diavolo.
Yeah.
And once you get into this unrelenting area
that
I feel like doesn't even make sense for nuclear weapons testing, although maybe it does because it's so
there's
remote,
nothing there.
That then we're going to have you drop off a couple shirts. So the Americans then come behind you and find these shirts.
Yeah.
There's a lot of steps you got to get through in order for that one to make sense.
So is the theory then that the KGB killed everybody on this expedition, or maybe that Senyam did it, but then he didn't make it out either?
That theory is that Semyon, I guess, failed in his mission, and people found out what was going on, that he was an inside person, and he had to sort of get rid of everyone. The other way the KGB is involved, with KGB agents potentially showing up and just murdering this group of people, is military testing. That they were doing some sort of nuclear testing or some other sort of missile testing in the area.
Yeah.
And that the Dyatlov group witnessed something they weren't supposed to see.
Okay.
And the Russian government had to come in and get rid of that threat of knowledge leaking out.
Right.
There were some pictures. I think some of the last pictures that were found on any of the camera rolls of these odd, just big glowing balls in the sky, presumably in the sky. I don't think you can really tell a backdrop for them. There were some reports from other people in the area, other hikers that were, you know, tens of, or hundreds of kilometers away of seeing odd lights in the sky towards the area that the Dyatlov group was camping. So the idea is those lights were some sort of weapon testing. The Dyatlov group heard these bombs going off or saw these bright flashes in the sky, cut themselves out of the tent or left the tent, witnessed these things, and then the KGB somehow knew that they were there and showed up and killed this group or scared them out of the tent and eventually killed them.
And you mentioned that, I think it was the people who they found in their underwear had like burns on their skin. Was there any way to tell if that was maybe from like chemical burn or like a nuclear?
I don't know that was ever looked into. I think it was just kind of assumed that it was from the fire. It could have been chemical burns. If this theory is the one that is the answer, it could have been some sort of radiation burns or something like that.
in my head, they would look like way worse probably when they were found if it was like something in that territory. But I guess if it's an experimental thing, maybe I could see some possibility there.
Yeah. And you would think that those injuries would go beyond just two individuals.
Yeah, it'd be on everybody. That's a good point.
It'd be on a lot of them. And so that's the military testing theory. They became privy to some sort of information they weren't supposed to know. Mm-hmm. And the KGB essentially opened the tent up and were like, all right, we got to
take care of this.
Yeah. And they cut themselves out the back of the tent, and then the KGB chased them down the ridge. The last theory, which I think is probably the most realistic theory, aliens.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I think aliens got them. I think the lights in the sky were definitely UFOs.
Yeah, always the most likely.
Probably case closed, really.
Yeah. Had they been probed?
Not that we know. Okay. I think the aliens, maybe not an abduction situation.
Okay. Yeah, more of a take care of
a show humanity. Of force,
yeah,
let's
okay.
say.
Yeah. Gotcha. Okay.
So those are all the theories. And so now comes your job. I need closure. I need to know what happened here. So Evan, tell me what happened.
So thanks for giving me the rundown, first of all. I think you broke it down for me pretty well. I think I lean towards the military testing. I feel like there's also a lot of like experimental weapons testing happening back then. So maybe even if not nuclear, they're doing so many kind of like weird psychological tests back then. But the only thing I can't figure out in my head is the physical harm, like their chest being crushed in and stuff. So that part is where I'm still kind of spinning my wheels. But
so I might be able to help you out with that piece okay. a little bit. Some of the theories propose that the chest injuries that were caused by, quote, a force beyond a human could do. A lot of people believe that is simply because of the volume of snow that was on top of them.
Okay.
I think it was 4 meters, which probably comes out to 12 or 13 feet. And so that would probably be thousands of pounds of snow.
That's a great point. So, yeah, I think some kind of combination of, like, it's so strange the way that they were spread out, but it also seemed like they were all trying to maybe get away from something. So seeing the things in the sky could maybe be some sort of test. And then as they're trying to get away from it, have varying degrees of unlucky. So maybe the last people who were just kind of out of the outreach of its effect were trying to make that second camp. And then the final effects still kind of took them in the end.
I like that theory. That is probably, that and avalanche are probably the top two theories that people have.
Yeah. So does that bring you closure? Where do you feel like you're at on this one now?
So I'll say, when we decided to do this podcast, this was the case that first came to mind for me.
Mm-hmm.
This is a case that I really wanted to cover because I had heard about it. I knew some of the details, but I didn't know a lot of the specifics about the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started researching this case maybe 10 days ago. And I really jumped down the rabbit hole on it. I'll literally be laying down to go to bed at night and be like, why did they leave the tent? And I cannot for the life of me figure it out. And so my answer as to what happened is something happened that made them leave the tent. And they were qualified for this. They knew what they were doing. They were smart. They were intelligent. They were rugged. They left the tent willingly, with a plan of going back down to the tree line and sort of regrouping there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they had planned to go back to where the Labaz was with all their supplies.
Yeah.
They went off route and they ended up at the tree line. They realized we're not where our supplies are. And so they started pulling branches off the trees, starting a fire, as I would imagine one would do in this survival situation.
Sure.
They regroup at the fire at the tree line. And then Igor Dyatlov says, okay, me and these other two individuals, we're going to go back to the tent. The other four are saying, okay, we need something a little bit better than just an open fire in the woods.
Yeah.
So they go further into the woods to try and create some sort of structure, some sort of safety, find something that could have given them some protection from the elements.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether or not those two that passed away by the fire, where in this timeline that happened, I don't know. But presumably it would have been before the four went further into the woods because they had taken the clothes off of them.
Yeah.
And then, as you said, just unlucky turn after unlucky turn.
Yeah.
And so the three going back to the tent, they just weren't able to make it. It was through deep snow. They didn't have the right kind of clothing. They froze to death. The four going into the ravine, again, you're just in an unforgiving environment. And so they end up passing away. We talked about the chest injuries.
Yeah.
And so none of this accounts for how Rustem Slobodin was found with major skull fractures and injuries. He was the one that was actually in the middle of the three going back to the tent.
Okay.
And so if all of the major physical trauma happened only to the four in the ravine, it's potential that it could have just been the weight of the snow and all that. But yeah, there is one on the way back to the tent that had major damage to his skull. And so I think ultimately all of them passed away because they just weren't able to manage this unmanageable situation. Now, like I said, I ignored the entire question of why did they leave the tent?
Yeah.
And I cannot for the life of me come up with a reasonable explanation for why they left the tent.
And cutting your way out is a strange way to do it when you probably want to keep that tent intact no matter what your next plan is. I don't see much reason to destroy it on your way out.
Yeah,
unless
correct.
You're really trying to haul out of there for some reason.
In my mind, something appeared at the front of the tent that scared them so badly that they cut their way out of the tent and ran into negative 22 degrees Fahrenheit weather without appropriate clothing. Given their experience, it had to have been something terrifying.
Yeah.
And I cannot figure out what it could have been. There was a time when I was doing this research that I was like, it was a bear.
Yeah.
Like a bear definitely like appeared at the front of the tent. But then I dig into it. I'm like, well, the food was left there. There were no tracks of any animals. And then you go to the weapons testing idea that you proposed. And that's one of the more popular explanations for this case. But why would they cut themselves out of the tent? Even with the weapons testing, if you would think if they heard something or saw something, they would simply go out the front of the tent.
My only thinking there is if the tent in my head is probably closed, but if the front was open and you, let's say it's one of these orb things that people have confirmed seeing, if that's at the front of the tent and it's coming towards you, you might be like, well, I'm not going out that way. Let's cut our way out the back.
Yeah. I guess if there was a really bright flash of light or like an explosion or something towards the front of the tent, if it's loud enough, if it's bright enough, you might panic. And again, we don't know when this happened, so they could have been dead asleep.
Yeah.
And been woken up by a loud blast or a bright flash of light or something and cut their way out of the tent.
Is there any evidence of military testing happening in that area at the time, or do we...
Not that I know
have
of.
Any record of, and obviously I don't think the KGB would be too willing to share that information, but I don't know if there's like a U.S. source that's like, oh, that day, that time, we have record of like raised radiation levels or something like that.
Yeah, not that I know of. Now, you know, as forthcoming with information as communist Russia was, I don't think we'll ever know any information. I will say the Russian government was kind of a little bit sketchy in how they handled this whole case. There were Russian pilots that were brought in with the helicopters to fly the bodies out. And one of the pilots refused to fly any of the bodies out unless they were in zinc-lined coffins. Zinc specifically because it's used to ward off biological things.
Yeah.
So, and that sounds really threatening, but like some roofers will use zinc flashing on roofs in order to stop mold growth and things like that. And so presumably the pilot had some sort of fear about some sort of biological contamination or something.
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, like there was a lot of paranoia at that time, I think it's fair to say. So not the most out of left field thing, but also, I mean, he may have known something about what he was going to pick up. And
yeah, if I'm a communist Russian helicopter pilot and I'm told to go out to this sketchy crime scene.
Yeah. Go to Siberia.
Yeah, go to Siberia, pick up these mysterious bodies that passed away. I probably would want some sort of level of protection from whatever might be going on.
Yeah.
The only other thing that the Russian government did that was a bit sketchy, well, not the only thing, they did a lot of stuff that was sketchy, but in this case, is they really tried to control the burials and the funerals of these individuals. They refuse to let them be buried in the same cemetery for a long time. Today, they're all buried together. Hmm. But the Russian government tried to control a lot of that stuff.
And just because of how they are, it's hard to know if that's like a very big piece of evidence or just them kind of another day in Russia.
That could be the whole story, or it could be none of the story, because I feel like the Russian government in 59, anything that could have possibly been embarrassing towards them, they were going all out to cover up.
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, this is a case that I don't think will ever be solved. I would love to eventually do a follow-up episode on this with some extra information or new developments that have been made. But until then, I think we're going to have to leave this one unsolved.
Yeah. For what we have right now, I think that's pretty much the best we can do. But if you guys have any theories of your own, we'd love to hear them. You can follow us on Instagram at the Oddity Archive Podcast. We'll have a post for this episode in particular. You can drop us a line there and let us know your leading theory. You can also send us an email at oddityarchivepodcast@gmail.com. Let us know if there's any topics you'd like for us to cover or any mysterious happenings that maybe happened to you.
Yeah, I'm always open to adding new files to the archive.
Sounds good. We'll see you guys in the next one.
See ya. I am David Stooldreher, creator and host. I'd like to thank Evan Miller, co-creator, and audio mixing. All art done by Tannis. You can follow her at Tannis Tattoos or at Black Rabbit Tattoo on Instagram. And original music composed by Sean Bullock.